Welcome back to The Popular Show with me, James A. Smith. This is a very special episode where we're joined by Anthony Lehrman. He is the author most recently of Whatever Happened to Antisemitism, Redefinition and the Myth of the Collective Jew. Anthony has held many important roles, academic and in Jewish civil society over the decades, and has been one of the most important voices in the debate over the definition of antisemitism. Thanks so much for making some time for us on The Popular Show.
You're welcome. Nice to be here, James.
We've got a hell of a story and a hell of a history, really, in this latest book. And I thought we'd begin with Jeremy Corbyn and the ordeal that many of us on the left, Jewish and otherwise, have gone through since 2015. I want to go back and get the whole story, but maybe we can just start there, just to kind of get your position on the table, so we know what we're dealing with here. From inside the Corbyn ordeal, as I've come to refer to it, it's easy to feel like this represented a kind of culmination of the story you describe of the redefinition of antisemitism since the 1970s. Do you feel at this point that the Corbyn affair is such a crystallization, or is such a kind of major event in the history of the definition of antisemitism, or do you have another way of looking at it?
No, I think it is a major event in the history of the redefinition of antisemitism. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I wouldn't call it a culmination, because this is a rolling exercise, if you like. This is something which hasn't just been brought to an end. Keir Starmer might feel that he's brought it to an end as the Labour Party is concerned. I personally wouldn't agree with that position, but this is something which is still ongoing. The battle over the definition is continuing, and as I'm sure you know, there are still people writing about the Corbyn saga, the Corbyn antisemitism saga. You know, more stuff is coming out all the time. People are still debating it on Twitter backwards and forwards. But it was certainly a major event in this redefinition, especially because one of the major problems that Corbyn faced when he was leader was dealing with the formal redefinition, dealing with the issue of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition and whether the Labour Party was going to accept it in full. And then, you know, he wanted some changes, and that, you know, that contributed very, very significantly to the problems that he faced as far as being accused of antisemitism is concerned.
What is the new antisemitism? This is the formulation or the intellectual idea at the heart of the history you tell in this most recent book.
Yeah, well, the new antisemitism is a term applied to essentially the notion that anti-Zionism and antisemitism are one and the same thing. They equal each other. That's to put it kind of in a very sort of simple and straightforward way. And that's a process which began about 40, 45 years ago, putting that message out. You know, pro-Zionist, Zionist groups and Jewish groups began to use that kind of idea, but it took some time really for it to become dominant. And that really wasn't till the 1990s, and then more fully after 2000. Up to that point, really, there was either it wasn't regarded as an equation which was legitimate, and it was enough, the consensus definition that existed before then was enough to explain even aspects of where things that people might say about Israel could be anti-Semitic. That's the way things were really sort of in the 80s and early 90s. But gradually it became more and more a notion taken up by Jewish and Zionist organizations that these two things were one and the same. And it was after 2000 that attempts began to be made to codify that relationship and to produce a definition which included the notion that anti-Zionism or severe criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. And that's really where we are now, in the sense that very much, and this is what I explain in my book, the understandings that we had about anti-Semitism up to the 90s and early 2000s have been radically changed. And now it's almost the default position of what anti-Semitism is the IHRA working definition of anti-Semitism, which I strongly dispute, and many, many others do. But the matter that we strongly dispute it, it's a definition that's run around the world and taken over in very many places and governments and international organizations and universities and in think tanks and so on. So the book, the redefinition of anti-Semitism, the redefinition is anti-Semitism having been redefined as hatred of Israel or criticism of Israel. And that's the story I tell, how that came about and the degree to which it has affected anti-Semitism studies and the politics of anti-Semitism and so on.
One sort of really striking thing about the post-2015 period was how so much of what had been regarded as debatable and disputable suddenly, almost overnight in Britain, became completely outside the bounds of legitimate debate. One of the crucial things about this book actually is the way it collects such a diversity of statements and arguments over this idea that since the 1960s there has been a new anti-Semitism focused on regarding Israel as the Jew of nations. Reading this book, you're just faced with remark after remark, and we'll get into some of them, that if they had been said, and they're coming from all kind of positions, sort of cross-sections of debate over this new anti-Semitism idea, remarks which, if they'd been said in Britain after 2015, would have been regarded as unacceptable, as anti-Semitic tropes, etc., etc. The kind of way that the new anti-Semitism thesis seems to have become virtually hegemonic in recent times, it is an astonishing thing to grapple with. And I think really it comes down to the enormous amount of ignorance about this history among most people, including people on the left, including many activists and including many people in the media. When especially younger supporters of Corbyn were faced with arguments that more or less articulated the idea of the new anti-Semitism from, say, the Jewish Labour Movement or from the Jewish Board of Deputies, those younger leftists were often willing to sort of defer to this. It sounded quite convincing. And if these institutions, which were supposedly kind of neutral spokespeople for the Jewish community, if they were saying it, then it must be true. That the way that this was a fiercely argued over concept over decades seemed to kind of evaporate. And I think that's one of the really important things about your work, is that it pushes forward the fact that no, until very recently, this was really contested and should continue to be so.
Absolutely. And as you say, it does continue to be contested, and there's a very strong and active body of of academic opinion in particular, which continues to dispute it and to write about it. And indeed, the academic world is very much divided over this. This isn't just a battle, or hasn't just been a battle in the political world. It's been almost like a fight to the death among academics as well. So yes, it is. I mean, I think the word you use about how extraordinary it is that this new definition has taken over, that's exactly the right word. I mean, there's no parallel really in our understandings of anti-Semitism and in the history of the study of anti-Semitism of any one definition being taken up worldwide in the way that this has happened. And indeed it's frozen out, it's attempted to freeze out any other kind of understanding. There is, as I'm sure you know, an alternative, or at least one alternative that's specifically been designed to sort of compete with or complement the IHRA definition, and that is the Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism, which is indeed much better than the IHRA definition. But however, it may be better on paper. In reality and in practice, as we've seen in this country and elsewhere, it can't catch up at all with the way IHRA has taken on. So yes, I think you're also right in saying that that if people who kind of sort of respect the institutions of the Jewish community, if young people were seeing that those institutions were saying that this is something, this new definition, this new anti-Semitism was something that had to be taken up and made the basis of our full understanding of anti-Semitism, then that's like saying, you know, minorities should be able to decide for themselves what their own racism is. And if that is the case, then yes, it seems right that Jews and Jewish organizations should be able to do the same. An assumption, an argument which I fundamentally dispute, and in fact, you know, it's something that comes from the McPherson inquiry, or supposedly comes out of the McPherson inquiry into the death of the black teenager Stephen Lawrence, was this notion that that minority ethnic groups should be able to decide for themselves what the racism that affects them is. That was never the case. McPherson never actually said that, but that notion has taken hold very, very strongly. And so therefore people say, well, if Jewish people think that's anti-Semitic, then that must be anti-Semitic. But, you know, we have to have in this field, both of anti-Semitism studies and racism studies, we have to have some objectivity here. There must be some objective way, at least, to try and define these things. And what's happened with the new anti-Semitism and the codification of that is that it's thrown that objectivity out of the window and basically says, well, if a certain body of Jews feel this, then it must be right. And that assumption is wrong.
It's sometimes called standpoint epistemology, the idea that only a member of a certain group can describe the experience of oppression. And apart from the influence of a certain reception of the McPherson inquiry in Britain, the other kind of big influence on this is presumably black activism in the United States, and how that has, in the age of the internet, come so kind of porously into British political discourse among the young. I think that might be another reason why the younger left was particularly primed to be insecure about, maybe there is something kind of benighted or potentially anti-Semitic about Corbyn and some of his cohort in this left leadership. But I think that is just, again, a kind of a really unhelpful meeting of discourses, not least because, as you detail, this has been an intra-Jewish conflict, quite as much as it's been one of Jews against non-Jewish anti-Semites. It has, from the start, been an intellectual battle and a battle of definitions within within Jews. And I think people are starting to understand that or accept that a little bit more when faced with Keir Starmer targeting, it seems, anti-Zionist Jews much more explicitly than anyone else ever has, and perhaps now that there's less at stake in the arguments, there's no prospect of a socialist prime minister in Britain, people are maybe starting to listen or accept a little bit more that something slightly grotesque or absurd has taken place. I don't know if it looks like that from your side.
Well, I wish that was the case, James. I'm not so sure. I think, you know, it's quite right to point out what's happened in the Labour Party and what Keir Starmer has done, and the way he himself, in his so-called effort to root out anti-Semitism, has turned the whole notion of anti-Semitism upside down by targeting certain Jews. I mean, the idea that you make the Labour Party a safe place for Jews by expelling other Jews just is absolutely absurd. But the fact of the matter is, he has been very successful in putting over this notion that, yes, the Labour Party has changed and it's all different and so on and so forth. And that's something which, you know, which we're struggling with, I think, to really fully come to grips with. How can this be the case? How can this expulsion and this treatment of these people go on under the guise of combating anti-Semitism? So you know, that's in a sense, it's an additional thing that's been thrown at us all, having to come to terms with that. And actually, we don't want to come to terms with that. We want to, you know, one wants to find a way of simply pointing out to people that this cannot be right. It cannot be right to take, you know, veteran anti-Zionists and people who have been part of the, you know, South African anti-apartheid struggle and so on and so forth, and take their activism and their anti-Zionism and turn it into something which, you know, is said to be anti-Semitic. And there is no basis, you know, in the history of Zionism and the history of anti-Zionism to see anti-Zionism as per se anti-Semitic. There's a very important history of the majority of Jews before the Holocaust being, if not, as it were, labeling themselves anti-Zionist, nonetheless being against Zionism. They just did not support Zionism. They didn't see that was the future for Jews. They had other notions of the future for Jews, or they didn't think about future for Jews in those way, in that particular way. So the whole idea that one can simply, you know, in a sense, rewrite history and turn anti-Zionism, which even for Jews was a respectable position, into now something which is equivalent to anti-Semitism doesn't really stack up. But, you know, try and make those arguments with Starmer and with his people and the people who support him and with the Jewish labor movement, and we find we don't get anywhere.
In your sort of history of being so involved in human rights organizations and anti-racist organizations and so on, did you come across Keir Starmer personally or professionally in past decades?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, the only, and I haven't had any personal contact with him. I can tell you that I was part of a small group of people that tried after he became leader to try and open up a dialogue with him about how the Labour Party might deal with the issue now that now that Corbyn was no longer there, because and this was before the purge began, so there was some hope that maybe this person who had made himself look as if he was a friend, he said Jeremy Corbyn is my friend, and that we would carry on the same policies, etc., etc. So there was naively some hope that he might listen to some, you know, new ways of thinking about dealing with the issue of anti-Semitism, and not necessarily going along with everything that the Jewish labor movement wanted. But that initiative, I can't name any names here, didn't get anywhere in the end. It looked as if the party under David Evans was going to be ready to listen to this and to possibly set up a meeting with Starmer, but in the end it just all fizzled out, and it was hard to understand why at the time. It became pretty clear shortly after that that the idea must have been from the very beginning that the way he was going to deal with this issue was just to clear out the people who he thought were troublemakers and do everything he could to appease the Board of Deputies of British Jews and other Zionist organizations.
It's a pretty sad instance of the cunning of history that the celebrated human rights barrister should be the one to finally cement this ultra-conservative interpretation of the new anti-Semitism as the only possible and acceptable one in Britain. A complete disaster. Let's get a bit of the long story of how we got here. In the immediate post-war decades, the relationship of Jews and Israel and anti-Semitism actually looked very different. In America, Jewish civil society tended to want Jews to kind of keep their head down and integrate and not go on about the Holocaust and not go on about their life in old Europe. Israel tended to take a sort of dim view of diaspora Jews and didn't really see itself as responsible for their well-being. They were the kind of neurotic, defeated ones who struggled under anti-Semitism in their own home countries, whereas in Israel, this was the kind of land of virility and the new kind of strong Jew. And socialists in the West tended to be favorable to Zionism and see Israel as a kind of socialist experiment. And of course, that was part of your own experience of moving to Israel in the 1960s. Something changed very sharply after the 1967 war. Could you describe something of that transition and how the new kind of fault lines came to be in the 1970s?
Well, you've set out the history, you know, fairly well there a period actually in the first years of the state, the first few couple of decades of the existence of the State of Israel. Israel actually didn't want to have anything to do with anti-Semitism. It didn't want to get involved in the issue of whether there was or wasn't anti-Semitism in diaspora Jewish communities, because Zionism was supposed to be the answer to anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. So if they were seen to be getting engaged with diaspora communities on those kinds of issues, it would have been an admission of failure of the way they saw Zionism and its purpose. But it is true to say that that with the Holocaust and with the establishment of Israel, any strong formal anti-Zionist position among Jewish organizations, etc., really fell away. I mean, there's one, for example, in America, the American Jewish Committee, one of the major American Jewish organizations, was upright, you know, through the 20s and 30s, and I think even, well, certainly up to then, they were an anti, they were against Zionism, and some of the religious Jewish denominations, the Reform movement, for example, was also not in favor of Zionism. But that kind of fell away, and Zionism did become the sort of dominant notion, the dominant idea of, you know, what Jewish existence sort of was all about, not completely, but certainly that it was a right thing. I think, you know, the acceptance of it was a lot to do with the Holocaust and the experience that Jews had in the Holocaust, and the left putting aside nationalism for Jews. I mean, the left fundamentally was anti-nationalist, but it was felt that, you know, Jews should be given a free pass here on this because of their experience. So in those first couple of decades after the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, there was this notion of the plucky little State of Israel, you know, having come into existence against all the odds and against the you know, the Arab states that wanted to push the Jews into the sea. I mean, all things now we know to be largely very effective propaganda, but nothing to do with the truth. And I think after 1967, that notion of plucky little Israel and Zionism as a national liberation movement, which everybody could like, was suddenly seen to be incorrect because of how quickly and how powerfully Israel was able to deal with the Arab states during the 1967 war. And so it was then, in particular, from then on, the opposition to Zionism began to develop more in among the left, and the Palestinian national movement, which was really kind of in the doldrums or hadn't really come into existence properly before 1967, after that began to develop. Developments also internationally in the United Nations, where African states and communist states took up, many of them, quite a kind of anti-Zionist position. And then there was the passing in 1975 of the UN resolution equating Zionism equating Zionism with racism. Mm-hmm. And you get this change of atmosphere. And at the time in 1975, for example, you had the former, he was then the foreign minister of Israel, Abba Iban, stating in the United Nations how this resolution was utterly evil, and how could Jews be accused of being racist, and so on and so forth. And there was a big reaction inside Israel as well, in the newspapers. How can they talk about us like that? You know, we Jews are the ones that know what racism is all about. And these African states that have voted for this resolution, you know, they should know better. And the language that was being used in Israel, quite interestingly, in newspapers and so on, was racist language about Black African countries for voting for this resolution. I mean, it's quite disturbing and disgusting, actually, when you look at that. So that's when it all really began to change, and the issue of so what are we going to do about this anti-Zionism that's now coming to the fore? That's when the debate began to develop within the Jewish world, and you know, between Israel and other countries, and so on and so forth. And that's really where Jewish organizations, as you yourself have said, this was very much an intra-Jewish debate, and the formal discussions that went on about this it certainly wouldn't be right to look at it as a kind of cynical exercise of people who just wanted to find some way of excusing Zionism. And there was this genuine debate that went on for a while about, well, you know, what do we do with this anti-Zionism? You know, is this anti-Semitism or not? And as I show in my book, in the discussions that went on in the late 70s, in the 1980s, and the beginning of the 1990s, you have serious discussion about it. It's not a kind of people pretending to think that this is, you know, a fine, you know, pleasant, nice ideology. This was something. And one of the reasons is because it had become so close to so many people's hearts in the Jewish world that Zionism was something which was indeed a liberation for Jews. But there was division of opinion at that time about it, and it's only over the, you know, over that period of late 80s and into the 1990s that began to change, and the weight of opinion shifted very much towards the notion that anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism are one and the same, with 9/11 and events around that time being a decisive moment in the triumph, if you like, of the new anti-Semitism becoming the default understanding of what anti-Semitism is.
The account that you give of the developments in the 1990s are quite a valuable case study in how an idea can be spread and come to seem like common sense. So the massive sort of change that took place after 9/11, we can get into how that affected the deployment of the new anti-Semitism thesis. But really, the important thing to get is that institutionally, the ground had been set before in the 90s. You refer to a proliferation of institutional actors assessing, identifying, and making judgments about the state of anti-Semitism in the 1990s. Could you explain something of that kind of institutional shape? What were the rivalries? What were the dynamics? And also, what was the role of Israel itself in intervening in the shape that those actors took?
Well, those actors were particularly the main ones were already in existence by the end of the 80s. Those actors were, for example, the major American Jewish organizations, one of which I've already mentioned, the American Jewish Committee, but there was also the Anti-Defamation League in the United States, and then came into existence a body called the Simon Wiesenthal Center. And you had also on the international stage, the World Jewish Congress being a major actor in this area, and also national Jewish representative organizations in Jewish communities, like the Board of Deputies in Britain, and like in France the CRIF, as it was called, all involved in some form or another with monitoring anti-Semitism relating to security organizations, police, and so on and so forth on it, and with governments. But there was very little involvement or interference in any of that on the part of the Israelis. There was a department at the end of the 80s which was beginning to produce information about anti-Semitism around the world. And they would send it out to Jewish organizations. It was extremely poor material sent out with any kind of serious judgment about whether what they were reporting to Jewish communities around the world. It was very unclear, really, whether some of the things they were saying were anti-Semitic or not. But a big step change happened at the end of the 80s. When Israel, as a state, as a government, decided that it was going to get into the business of not only monitoring anti-Semitism, but they wanted to put itself at the forefront of all the monitoring activities going on around anti-Semitism among Jewish organizations worldwide. And this was very much related to Israel's deteriorating international position in the world at that time. And it was quite clearly an effort, on the one hand, to energize young Jews in diaspora communities worldwide to become more Zionistic, and that this might lead to more immigration to Israel. But it was also already then seen as a tool which Israel could use in its own sort of battles on the international stage. And it very much contributed to the politicization of anti-Semitism during that period. We call it weaponization now. That word wasn't used particularly at the time. We spoke simply of politicization. And a struggle went on during the 1990s, initially between some of these Jewish organizations and the state agencies themselves, because the Jewish organizations actually rather jealously guarded their own control over this area and their own work in this area. They didn't really want Israel to interfere in any particular way. But that eventually fell away. And eventually all of the major organizations, they fell in behind the Israeli effort. The particular organization that I ran at the time, which was initially called the Institute of Jewish Affairs and became the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, which still exists to this day, we chose not to go along with that. And we were frozen out of the work that was going on in monitoring by some of the major organizations around the world, because we were not seen to be kosher, as it were, as far as this work was concerned. So it's that coming into this field on the part of Israel, which was a decisive step change. As I say, it was kind of hit and miss to begin with, because the Jewish organizations weren't entirely happy about it, but also because you yourself know this, that in the Oslo Accords in 1993 put a whole different complexion on what was happening as far as Jews and Israel, Palestine is concerned. There was a lot of kind of optimism, which we now know was really not really very well founded by any means. So even Israel stepped back for a little while from this desire to front up the anti-Semitism work, because it wanted to concentrate on its notion of the peace that it was signing with the Palestinians. But when that all began to go wrong, within a very short period of time, assassination of Rabin and so on and so forth, Israel once again then came in to this field in a very big way at the end of the 90s, but particularly after 9/11 and the developments that happened there. And really, you have, I won't say it's been seamless, but you've had a constant further encroachment of Israel and its own priorities into this field of dealing with the issue of anti-Semitism, such that, you know, it has become now today almost impossible to separate out Israel's political and international and geopolitical objectives from what is real and what is not real anti-Semitism.
After 9/11, Israel the new anti-Semitism thesis became even more prominent, to the point that, as you point out in the book, a lot of academics working on anti-Semitism seem to have the impression that the new anti-Semitism thesis is a creature of the 2000s, when of course it goes back much further than that. But clearly it becomes a lot more rhetorically important, and that institutional work put in by conservative Jewish bodies and by Israel in the 1980s and 90s starts to bear fruit, we might say. One of the dynamics that you point out is the way that anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism, and anti-Westernism became blurred with each other in a lot of the discourse. Israel sort of has a strange place in a lot of that kind of discourse about Islam after 9/11. On the one hand, we have the stereotypes of the anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that Israel, whatever the Jews were warned not to go into the World Trade Center, all that sort of thing. But on the other hand, Jews and Israel have a strangely kind of functional place in a lot of the pro-Iraq war positions. If you look back at, say, Nick Cohen's writing of the time in defense of Tony Blair and in defense of the Iraq war, or you look at the Houston Manifesto and the kind of texts coming out of there, all of these extremely pro-war bodies and commentators in the early 2000s in Britain, they will make that kind of seamless slip from the left are defending these oppressive Islamic regimes, or they're defending Saddam Hussein, and also they are anti-Israel. There's this kind of, sometimes it seems like a sort of non sequitur, or just this kind of extra accusation that gets thrown in. But those things do get kind of mixed up. That the left is suspicious because it is too friendly with Muslims, it is anti-Semitic, and it's also anti-war. And these claims only become more vicious and forcefully made in the 2000s as it becomes clear that the Iraq war and the war in Afghanistan were total disasters. That cementing of a kind of disgust and dislike and a desire to discredit anti-war positions is that's a new ingredient, isn't it, into this fight to redefine anti-Semitism in the 2000s?
Yes, it is a new ingredient, but I think in a way it's sort of perhaps deeper isn't quite the right word, but the role that Israel has played, and I think actually, sadly, many Jewish organizations in this process of demonizing all Muslims for, you know, for things that have gone on, for jihadi terrorism and so on, is something, you know, which we really need to face up to. This is really this was an important factor in what was going on, I think, after 9/11. Israel wanted very clearly to see itself as part of the coalition of the willing, you know, George Bush's phrase, and that was a position which I think came to be adopted very much by Jewish communities, certainly the increasingly right-wing leadership of Jewish communities around the world. There were still very strong forces at that time, actually, within Jewish communities who didn't go along with that, and to this day, you know, work very, very hard for, you know, good intercommunal relations, particularly between Jews and Muslims and so on. But unfortunately, it became more or less a kind of default position for Jews to be seen to be lined up against not just jihadi Islam, but also against Muslims in general, which, you know, I think is a shameful thing. I mean, I encountered this myself in my own dealings with Jewish leadership during these years, the 90s and the 2000s, and it was really quite shocking the degree to which they didn't broadcast this necessarily, you know, openly to the world, but within within Jewish communal discussions, you could see this kind of attitude coming out quite strongly. And, you know, as we know also, I mean, you mentioned Nick Cohen here, but the neoconservatives in the United States, you know, quite a few of them came from Jewish backgrounds, and themselves weren't necessarily Zionists actually at one time, but became more Zionist after 9/11 because of what they saw was happening to Jews, and the role that they played in these developments is also quite significant. One has to be careful here because, you know, we're talking about specific individuals. We're not talking about a whole people or whole communities. But it is quite telling that these were people whose Jewish experiences, which at one time, which were very much coming from a left wing, a very strong left wing position. For example, there's this magazine called Commentary in the United States. I don't think it's so important now, but at one time it was very important. And it was a magazine that came out of the American Jewish Committee, actually. And the person who became the editor of this very important magazine was at one time very much on the left and then moved to the right and became neoconservative. So you have that developed. Something happens within the Jewish intelligentsia and among certain Jewish intellectuals to line up behind these really, you know, retrogressive and retrograde ideas as far as Muslims are concerned. And this is something which Israel itself has exploited as well in its own representation of the Israel-Palestine conflict. As to well, it depends. Sometimes they're trying to present it as a political struggle, but at other times they are contributing to the notion that this is some kind of religious struggle. Almost forgetting that actually, you know, there are Christians in the Holy Land and Israel-Palestine as well. But this is some kind of religious struggle between Muslims who are, you know, fundamentally anti-Semitic and Jews who are simply, you know, wanting their liberation and freedom in their own land.
You've sort of got a diversity of sometimes not especially coherent explanations for all this on the left. Either you would hear the argument that all of this was being done at the behest of the Israel lobby, and that ultimately the discrediting of the left was being done because the left was anti-Zionist and Israel needed to be protected. Or you'd have the position that would say, no, that is an anti-Semitic trope, and actually Israel is not a meaningful kind of part of this, et cetera, et cetera. But really, it seems like there was just available from 9/11 onwards a just very convenient kind of little Rubik's cube of interlocking pieces whereby you could simultaneously discredit the left's domestic agenda and in the Atlantic world. Both main parties wanted to get rid of that. You could discredit anti-imperialist and anti-war critiques that, after all, were coming from the right and the left in the early 2000s. You could discredit Muslim majority countries, and you could have a scapegoat at home in the form of domestic Muslims, and you could shore up your defense of Israel, and you had this quite convenient, decades in the making, moral shield in the form of being able to accuse all of those actors of anti-Semitism simultaneously. So different people and different bodies and different groups will have had different priorities among those different interlocking pieces. But the point is that they all seem to work pretty seamlessly together. And that is what we were up against on day one in 2015 when Corbyn was elected. And frankly, it seemed like not many people who were involved had any idea that this was the train that was coming down the tracks, that you had decades of ideological construction. You had 14 years of escalation of that and deployment of that against the left, Muslims, anti-Zionist Jews, etc. And now all of it was there as this kind of perfect spearhead ready to take down Corbyn, who of course was basically the human embodiment of all of those targets, the domestic leftist with the history of foreign policy critique, loved by the Muslim community, and the a guy surrounded by anti-Zionist Jews. So you could just work down the checklist, really.
Well, that's very well put, actually, because indeed, what happens after 9/11, within a few years. Israel's position geopolitically, begins to radically change. It benefits from neoliberalism. It becomes one of the states that is putting into practice neoliberalism, and rather in some ways more successfully than some other states that were doing it. You get certain Arab states who want to be part of this coalition of the willing because they didn't want to be themselves destroyed or affected by jihadi terrorism. So Israel's position becomes much, much stronger. It can put over its arguments about being this demonized state under threat all the time, and therefore in need of protection and need of support internationally, and it got it. The criticism that used to come from the EU in the 1980s and 1990s of Israeli practices just seemed to sort of disappear, really, or it maybe continued, but it was sort of toothless. It was just words. There was nothing to it. So you get a whole, collection of things coming together, which indeed, make it possible for what happens in 2015 to happen in such a kind of explosive way. Because as we know, that there are sort of studies of the media have been done, counting the number of articles before Jeremy Corbyn came to power that mention the word Corbyn and anti-Semitism, in the same piece. Up to 2015, there are literally none in like the 10 or 15 years before that. There isn't one article that links anti-Semitism and Jeremy Corbyn. Suddenly from 2015, it goes through the roof. You get over the next 5-6 years, I don't know, 7-8, I can't remember exactly the figures now, thousands. Now, that looks as if it came from nowhere. Of course, it didn't come from nowhere because of the exact things that we're now talking about, that really this... the build-up of the pushback or the circumstances to enable the pushback against Corbyn and his pro-Palestinianism and his willingness to talk to Hamas and these kinds of things, could be so strong because the groundwork had been laid and you had certain new organizations that had come into existence in the Jewish community. Who are unhappy with the mainstream organizations for not taking a tough enough stand on these kinds of things and on so-called anti-Semitism, on anti-Zionism. For example, the CAA, the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, notorious organization in my view, who spearheaded from within a major attempt to bring down Corbyn. I don't know whether you in my book I refer to the video that made by Joe Glassman, in which he takes credit as being the political organizer, the voluntary political organizer for the CAA, and he thanks in this video all of these people celebrities and artists and actors and academics and so on and so forth, who all work together to bring down Corbyn. Now, you know, that would have been inconceivable sort of 30 years ago for it to think anything like that could happen. But it just goes to show, I think, how strong and how powerful these forces backing the new anti-Semitism idea have become, not only within the Jewish world, but beyond that as well. It was a message that was being received more and more favorably internationally and on the world stage in various ways. And clearly, you know, Corbyn wasn't prepared for it. Corbyn, I think, you know, I personally think a lot of mistakes were made in the way this thing was dealt with. But, you know, one can excuse to a certain extent, because who could have predicted that this raging monster was coming down the track, this not out of control train, but it was a train that was very much controlled. And this is what hit, I think, him and the Labour Party when he became the leader.
I think it's very important that you've put your head out and discuss that Joe Glassman video, because I mean at the time people were willing to hear, okay, this guy's from the campaign against anti-Semitism. Well, that sounds good, because anti-Semitism is bad. And then you watch that video that he put out after 2019 that you analyze in the book. We've got a YouTube video analyzing it as well, actually, that I'll link below. It is extraordinary. As you say, the credit that he claims and on behalf of these organizations for the demolition of Corbyn's reputation, exactly the kind of thing that you would be accused of having deployed an anti-Semitic trope about Jews and conspiring and the media, etc., if you'd said it as a critique. That's before we get on to the fact that in the way he talks about anti-Zionist Jews such as yourself as de-circumcisers, as a Gentile, shall I say, it just seemed like one of the most anti-Semitic things I'd ever seen. Like this was somebody whose hatred for another Jew is based on their Jewishness. If anyone hates Jews as Jews, then I felt like this guy did. He hates anti-Zionist Jews in their capacity as Jews, frankly. And he seemed far more excited about attacking them than even Corbyn himself. What is anti-Semitism, though? We heard a hell of a lot about tropes in those years. And as you point out, this was a term that was used in the academic literature, but wouldn't necessarily be one that people would recognize in the ordinary media or in discussions. But suddenly, you know, everybody was an expert on what was a surreptitiously anti-Semitic trope in whatever somebody had said. We heard a lot about how it was a virus, and we heard a lot about how we had to be at war with anti-Semitism. These are framings that you've criticized for a long time, actually. When we use those phrases, and after all, Corbyn himself used those exact phrases in his many apologies for his own conduct and the conduct of his allies. Not all of us thanked him for apologizing on our behalf, of course. Mm-hmm. So it's not just, you know, the antagonists of Israel's critics who use these phrases. Even the radical left, even the anti-Zionist left, even anti-Zionist Jews use these phrases as well. But how useful are they? Can they help us stop anti-Semitism? And how possible or indeed desirable is it to be at war with anti-Semitism?
Well, I think these terms are indeed counterproductive. I don't think that they help in any way in the fight against anti-Semitism, because words like war, words like virus, words like zero tolerance, words like, you know, ripping, tearing anti-Semitism up by its roots, Starmer's favorite phrase. They promise the end. They promise the most beautiful end, if I can put it that way, the eradication of anti-Semitism. I think that, you know, if there's anything that study of racism and study of anti-Semitism has taught us, and that is that that these things are there in society. They cannot be destroyed and rooted out in this particular way. It's a sad fact, I think, that these things are built into human existence and so on. And we will never, it sounds very pessimistic to say we will never get rid of racism, we'll never get rid of anti-Semitism. But it isn't, because what you can do, and what we know can be done, is one can push and find ways of pushing racism and pushing anti-Semitism into the margins, you know, through education, through the right kind of legislation, through the right kind of society, through the right kind of, you know, the right kind of state. There are all kinds of methods that can be used to minimize these things. But the idea that you can eradicate, that you can get rid of, that, you know, we're talking about a war, this somehow helps you do that, I think is just shown to be wrong. It sets up a situation where if someone says, well, I will do that, which is in a way what Corbyn, you know, said, you know, that he would do, that will always fail. So, you know, as a weapon against Corbyn, that was a very effective one, to talk about, you know, eradication, enough is enough, these kind of slogans that were being used. And of course, you know, it's very hard for someone like Corbyn under attack in that position not to go along with them in the sense of saying, well, yes, you know, that's what I want to do as well, but actually setting himself up and everyone else involved for failure, because that simply can't be achieved. So I think we do, you know, we really should try harder to get back to a position where we have a simple definition of anti-Semitism, which talks about anti-Semitism being hatred, a demonization, dehumanization, persecution of Jews and Jewish organizations, wherever that may appear. I mean, you know, there are lots of good, as it so happens, simpler definitions of anti-Semitism around. One particular person, a colleague and friend of mine, Brian Klug, who has done a lot of work on the definitions, and you'll find in his writings quite a few quite useful sort of shorter, simpler definitions, which I think, you know, in terms of what you need to use in order to be able to fight anti-Semitism, far better than anything that comes out of the IHRA working definition, and even dare I say it, the better one, the Jerusalem Declaration on anti-Semitism, which I think again is problem is it's too wordy. We don't need long wordy definitions. No Jew has ever been saved by a long definition of anti-Semitism. I mean, you know, that may seem like a ridiculous thing to say, but I mean, if you say a definition is useful, you have to show how it's useful, and all that the IHRA working definition has done is effectively act as a charter against Palestinians, and is actually a racist charter against Palestinians, and doesn't in any way, in my view, and lots of other people as well, I'm not alone in this, who feel that actually it's damaging for Jews. It doesn't help fight anti-Semitism. So we need we should work on the basis of short definitions and good education and understanding around those short definitions, which then people can use when they need to distinguish between something which is anti-Semitic and something which is not. And we even have to get away with that to some extent, because there is this tendency to now to look at anything to do with Jews within the frame of anti-Semitism. Oh, is that anti-Semitic or not? Well, there are lots of other ways you can look at relations between groups than simply saying, oh, is that relationship, you know, to do with racism? There are all kinds of other ways that groups interact with each other. So we need to get away from that kind of language into a simpler, if we need a definition. I mean, I just say that when I first started in this area of monitoring anti-Semitism in the 70s and through the 1980s and 90s, nobody ever asked us to define anti-Semitism when we issued our yearly report, which we did for a number of years. I write about in my book, I was engaged in being the first to produce a country by country survey of anti-Semitism, a yearly report from 1992, I think it was, to 1999. And all the years that we produced that report, which got a lot of press coverage at the time, nobody ever came to our press conference and said, well, you know, so how do you define anti-Semitism? There was a consensus understanding of what it was. So the idea that we needed any new definition was itself a political act. It wasn't something which emerged, you know, purely from academic discussion. This was very much something that was pushed by people. It was a political project. And we are, sadly, I think we can see the fruits of this now, and how neither does it help Jews, neither does it help Jewish relations with other groups. And it sets up, well, as we've seen, a hierarchy of racism in the Labour Party, where anti-Semitism, as the Ford report has shown, anti-Semitism has been prioritized about other forms of racism. And that kind of exceptionalism, I think, is wrong. It's not good for Jews. It doesn't help in terms of intercommunal relations. And also, we get to the situation that, you know, Jews have got their definition, you know, whether they like it or not, the IHRA. Any attempt to have a common definition for Muslims has just been turned down by the government in this country. They don't want to know. Now, can that be fair if you're having definition for one group and not giving one equal status for another group? There's really something wrong going on here.
Well, it has been, as you say, an extraordinary story, and one that is not over yet. We seem to be at a kind of awkward hinge point, really, where the brazenness of the suppression of dissident Jewish voices, who used to be well inside the mainstream until pretty recently, the shameless political deployment of this definition of anti-Semitism, and the shameless exceptionalism, whereby, you know, it's been decided that it's useful for Jewish interests to be treated in this way, and, you know, nobody with any power is going to insist that maybe other groups should also have that, if that's to be the terrain. None of which, as you say, helps ordinary Jews at all. I wish we could say something more conclusive, but we would certainly have avoided a lot of the errors of the post-2015 period if we had grasped the history better, and if we had grasped better the machinery that had been constructed against us, against the left, against anti-war people, against all but the most conservative Jews, really. But we have at last the information all in one place in Anthony Lehrman's Whatever Happened to Anti-Semitism, published by Pluto Books and very strongly recommended. Anthony, we can't thank you enough for appearing on the Popular Show to lay all this out for us.
Thanks very much for inviting me to be here. Thanks, James.